You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Okay, now we have half an hour for a session of question and answer. The person who wants to take the floor are asked, please, to present themselves very briefly. No, so we start from the left. You.
Hello, thank you, all of you, for wonderful presentations. I'm Abhijit Ghosh, and I'm a postdoc fellow at McGill University in Canada. One of the questions that I'm going to ask addresses Cecilia and Ms. Fontenot regarding partnerships between SSEs and governments. One of the themes that is often repeated when we talk about SSEs is the idea of autonomy and self-determination and so on. So when you start talking about partnerships with the government, does it in some ways, in your mind, does it take away from this whole notion of autonomy and self-determination? And if it does, then would it be right to classify these types of organizations which are actively receiving public support, actively receiving finances, monetary support from the government, would you be classifying these as SSEs at all? Is that clear?
Thank you so much. Next, you.
I also want to congratulate all the speakers for the great presentations. My name is David Chipanta. I work with UNAIDS on social protection. I would like to ask Anya, building on the issue that Cecilia raised around the issue of bureaucratization of the SSC in the case of Kerera, to also talk about the issue of elite capture. I think you mentioned earlier that Kerera is very patriarchal, so my sense is most likely the men would in a way still pull the strings and generally the program would be liable to elite capture. And since I work on HIV and AIDS, I want also to hear from you to what extent the issue of HIV, especially for people living with HIV, if to what extent they are covered in your program. And then lastly, also to Fontaine, to also just check from you in a way the specific countries that you are talking about, because my sense, having worked in West Africa, I think there are huge variations. Ghana, for example, you find that policies are much better than, for example, Liberia or Sierra Leone, and also to check with you to what extent the health insurance addressed issues of quality, because my sense is that in a number of West African countries, if you have money, you will get better quality, and if you have money, most likely you're not going to go into a health insurance scheme. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, you, the lady in the back.
Hi, I'm Aruna, and I'm a PhD student at University of London. First of all, congratulations to Ananya. I fell in love with Kutumbashree 7 years ago, and you've just rekindled the love. And there's a question for all three of you, four of you. Basically, when we talk about solidarity economy, it's often perceived as an alternative, an innovative alternative, which is coming out from people. And how I understand innovation is that it doesn't arise unless people feel the need of it. And the need comes from a crisis or a perception of a crisis. And the levels of the need will vary, whether people perceive the crisis before the crisis has actually happened or after the crisis has happened. And then so there are various stages at which they realize that there is a need for solidarity economy. emanating from this, I feel that from all the cases that you have mentioned, should we ponder upon the fact that certain societies are not ready for a model of solidarity economy, or certain communities are not ready for it, unless there is a certain level of development that has happened? Say, for example, in Kerala, you mentioned that the literacy rates are very high, people are better equipped, and hence they could probably pull it off. And in similar situations where the civil society is not strong enough to negotiate with the government, even though they are depending on the government for certain kinds of negotiations, does that count? I mean, talking of India, Bangladesh, West Africa, or Bolivia, the point is that are these communities equally ready for a model of solidarity economy as we talk here? And that probably decides their levels of performance or our assessment of the negativities which come out of it.
Thank you so much. You.
Thank you very much. I have a question actually on this gray zone between, on the one hand, civil society or social and solidarity economy, and on the other hand, the state. Actually, it goes a little bit in the same direction of the question of the sir, which is very clearly articulated when we're dealing with these welfare state services. And actually referring to the reference that you made, Mr. Jahe, on the Belgian system. Actually, at the moment, it's pretty much, actually, we have a very consolidated welfare state system, very much integrating not the NGOs that Ms. Russell mentioned, but actually trade unions and mutual benefit societies. And actually, at the moment, they're pretty much under criticism on two elements, I think. The first, the element of autonomy that has been, to which degree this puts into danger this autonomy of the civil society being involved in this policy making, where they criticize that actually you're putting these actors put on two different hats now, on the one hand being the beneficiaries, and on the other hand taking part in political decision making. To which degree do you agree with this comment, which goes actually a little bit in the opposite direction of the conclusion of Ms. Russell, no, that it's either only implementing actors. Here we have a very political actor in the sense of participating in decision-making, and secondly, very much a political actor in the sense of having a very strong political color. In the Belgian system, you have a more liberal, social democratic, more socialist background of this organization. So, okay, can you clarify a little bit that this tension, this gray zone of being involved in policy making, and secondly, of being a political actor in the sense of having a political color as being part of civil society? That's my question.
Thank you. You?
My name is Shu Fang Zhang. I work at UNRIST. So I have two questions for Anaya. I think you presented a very interesting case, but I cannot help for thinking with such a dynamic movement on the ground with so many women involved in so many different organizations. I'm wondering how the priority of development is set if different organizations represent different agenda. Do they have a conflict? And who gets the agenda on the top of development, whether that actually probably hinder some of the achievement of certain important development goals. The second is, as you present the case, and I also felt there's so much energy coming from this local movement, and then I understood the role of government is not really in the middle of driving the development. I'm wondering whether what would make this kind of situation a success? The two driving force from the civil society and from government. Whether you think there are occasions actually there need to be a balance between the agenda driven by the government and by the civil societies. If it is, what would be the balance, or what could be the potential negative impact? Given perhaps it's so hard to manage what's going on the ground. Sorry, thank you.
Thank you. It's up to you now.
My name is Mitya. And just two short questions. First is for Golam. And the question is whether you have perhaps considered linking the paradoxes that you listed to another paradox, which is basically that the strength of the social economy or the cooperative economy actually comes from the failure of the opposite model, call it neoliberal or however. And the second question is for Professor Mukherjee. So you mentioned that there is a lot of positive feeling among women in Kerala. If you could say one word or one idea or one value that you would like to communicate to politicians, female politicians in Europe.
Also male politicians, not only female politicians, because they need more.
Hello, thank you for the presentations. My name is Riwa Ubari. I'm a master's student at the University of Toronto and an intern at UNRIST. So my question is for Professor Fontenot. And I was wondering, you spoke about the relations between the state and the MHOs, but I was wondering about the relations between the public and the MHOs. Does the public want to bypass the state system, or is the public, you mentioned that the public is still not very trusting of the MHOs or doesn't really use these services yet. So I was wondering if you could clarify a bit about the public attitudes towards the MHOs. Thank you.
Okay, any other? Have I forgotten anyone? No, it seems no. So we'll start. You will have 4 minutes each. We'll reinverse the order. So Benedict, you will be the first.
Je vais essayer de donner quelques éléments de,
let me try and answer at least part of the questions which have been put to me. Beginning with the matter of autonomy or independence, there's a good reason why we keep coming back to this characteristic. It's because that is probably the one which is the most specific to the social and solidarity economy and is the distinction between it and the public sector. The fact of being independent and having the right of self-determination and deciding what it wants to do and choosing the path it wants to go along, that's what makes it specific and different. In the case I discussed earlier on, there is obviously the question of independence from the state, because when these social economy bodies have a partnership with the authority, then obviously its role will determine its position or status. They can no longer do exactly what they want. They can't choose to do exactly as they like. And in the region I was discussing, namely West Africa, of course, it depends on where you're talking about in West Africa. There is another actor who comes into play and influences the right of social organizations to self-determination, and that is technical and financial players who come in as well. So the right for SSEs to decide what to do will obviously be limited by what they can do because of the intervention by financial and technical organizations, and it does limit their right to self-determination. In the geographical zone that I was discussing in my paper, and I was referring in general terms to West Africa, in this part of the world, well, I'm referring more specifically to the French-speaking part of West Africa, where there's a group of countries pursuing very similar social protection programs. They're very similar. And they're not like the model in Ghana, which is more innovative and which is likely to prove far more effective than anything we have seen to date in West Africa, and at least in the French-speaking West African countries, which I discuss in my paper. So it's a different model to the Ghana model. As far as the standard of care is concerned, obviously in most of the French-speaking West African countries, but in particular in the urban centers, it is possible to have access to a high standard of health care if you can afford it, but that's not where the majority of the population lives. So there is a problem of fairness and equity in access to care and what healthcare providers give, where the high standard is usually in urban centers. And even there, they are only available to a minority of the population. So both, obviously, an attempt is made to raise healthcare standards, especially in public structures outside the urban centers. It's nearly always public centers in rural areas, but the effect of this is limited because mutual health organizations are too small to carry any weight with care providers. They have limited funds at their disposal, and obviously they are more influenced by patients' concerns. Then what about the attitude of the public to these mutual health organizations? That's a good point, because two issues arise. First of all, there's the aspect of the attractiveness of the system. How attractive is it? What does it offer by way of insurance packages? It's possibly not precisely what the population needs in insurance terms. And then there's the question of trust as well. There's a great deal of mistrust with regard to civil society organizations which manage public funds, like the organization we're discussing here. And unfortunately, that's not likely to make mutual health organizations more popular. Thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to be brief. Chechnya.
Thank you. I'll try to answer some of the questions, and maybe we could keep talking because there are a lot, and my English is not that good. I think probably one of the answers for the questions you raise is that you probably cannot understand what is going on in some developing countries with the framework we have, which is created, which has been created mostly in the developed ones. Actually, the question about autonomy, it's clearly a problem that at least in the cases I know, in mostly Latin America, autonomy is not real present, but still experiences of collaboration with welfare state and government and SSC actors are going on, have been going on for decades, more than 15 years in many other countries that I have studied. So we probably couldn't, if we take the frames of strictly the frames of SEC theory, we shouldn't call these NGOs and these grassroots organizations SEC actors, but actually we don't have any other way to call them now. So this is, they are not the state, they are not the market, they are not plain citizens, they are something, and they're nearer label that we find is this. Maybe we are wrong, and actually this is not SEC. But I warn you that, or I alert you that in Latin America at least, many, many researchers and politicians and practitioners are not only speaking of SEC, but also expecting a lot from the promises of the good qualities that I showed before. So I don't know. Maybe they are not SEC, but actually this is going on, and this is the way we have to study. Maybe we have to develop a new framework for studying this kind of partnerships, not in developed countries, but in developing ones. And the problems that we find there, we don't find them in developed countries. And this related to something that one of the participants said, and my colleague here, is not always SEC is strong where state is weak. In many countries, SEC is strong and states are strong. So, and the other way around, it's also empirically observed in many countries. So it's not really an equation of negative sum. I don't know how to explain this, but I don't know if the idea is clear. It's much more complex. And the other thing is, to finish, is that at least in the Uruguayan case, probably in other Latin American countries, we cannot detach the SEC analysis from right and left, regarding to your question, and political parties and structural liberal reforms on the 90s, because that is when this SEC story or tale came into the scene, and it came with international founding organizations, IMF, World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank. That's when this really took form, no? Started to gain strength. So we are trying to understand cases that are like radically different in their story, in their history, and in the story, recent story, than the other than the countries that develop actually this framework. So I don't really have an answer. I have more questions now after these questions of you. So I'm sorry.
Thank you. Sometimes a good answer starts from good questions.
I believe that.
So the third is Golan. You have the floor.
I already took much of our colleague's time, so I will be very short now. To answering Mitov on the strength of cooperative, I think there is a great source we can think of. Though I believe that there are some differences on social entrepreneurship as such to the cooperatives, but yeah, we can look at it and the strength of cooperatives to survive in the crisis and other thing is very important, I think. Again, social entrepreneurship comes with the addressing social problems. That is the whole problem, because cooperatives they do the employment, generate employment, other things, but they're not totally mandated to do the solve the social problems. So that is the conceptual thing. So I think still cooperative is the main source where we can find so many kind of solution for this concept. But we have to touch upon the drawbacks of the even NGOs. Some of the big NGOs, they made great improvement in the people's life. We can have the inspiration from the NGOs as well. So I think NGOs, these are the sources we can take the lessons. And on the developmental context, I completely agree with Aruna that I think that it depends on the development and civil society and how you're going to negotiate with the state and other parties. And for social and solidarity economy, in a basic conceptual level, I think that should be there in every society. There is a need because we have inequality, we have other problems. But what would be the modus operandi? That can change due to the context. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. And last but not least, Mrs. Ananya.
Very interesting question. The first one was the threat of bureaucratization and elite capture, I think. The threats are less than in other cases only because the Kudumbashi bureaucracy is a very specific bureaucracy. However, there are threats from otherwise. For example, governments have other programs. Different parties come in, they have other programs. Kerala has a very interesting history of every 4 years changing its government, which is the reason why governments want to come with their own programs. And I've asked this question to women specifically, and their answer is that it is the structures of solidarity that prevent them, that give them the ammunition to fight elite capture and bureaucratic intervention, because their local planning has to be done through those community development societies, which then have to go back to the community, to the neighborhood groups, to the villages. And this is how, with the different levels of solidarity, they resist elite capture. Do they succeed every time? Mostly they did. Actually, there have been quite a few attacks on certain aspects of the model, which the women have resisted through these structures of solidarity. And the other thing they say in terms of the question you raised is, if it's male-dominated, are the men pulling the strings? And here the resounding answer from women is, because of the structures of solidarity, that even their personal relations of patriarchal domination have changed. And that then gets projected back into the group solidarity. And they have a program called Gender Self-Learning, where groups learn from each other. And this has tremendously protected women from being subject to patriarchal domination or elite capture and so on. I think I disagree with Aruna on the question of does there need to be a certain level of development. I think part of me doesn't want to agree, because if we have ceded to this, then we have lost the case for an ongoing movement. But even if you look at Kerala, the reason why it has these successes in human development are because of solidarity movement. We did not call them solidarity movements now. They were other kinds of social and people's movement. That is why Kerala has that. So the Kerala's development is an outcome of people's movements. And that's one reason why I don't believe that there has to be a stage which we reach before we can invest in the solidarity economy. The second is, if you look at the world around us now, there are some of the most oppressed and marginalized groups who are still using solidarity as a resource to form movements. You know, the Brazilian movements are one very good example. The indigenous movements everywhere are very good examples. These groups have nothing else except solidarity as a resource. And so I would think that in every social situation, at every set of social relations, solidarity provides an opportunity or opens up pathways which individual approaches cannot, right? I work with this, have worked with this movement in Latin America. Their slogan is, it's called the Women's Development Network, that we can always achieve more together than we can alone. And I think that remains true for every set of social relations. The question you raised about, can there be conflicting agendas? So who sets the agenda? Remember, this is really organized at the local level at multiple, they are lateral agenda-setting movements going on. So other than some basic macroeconomic framework of literacy or health, the local agendas are set through the local plans, right? So there are multiple local plans. Which can be pursued by the multiple municipalities at the same time. Very interesting sources of conflict emerge, for example, between men and women. So if there are land, there's a plot of land which needs to be developed, does it go into commercial development? Do we have a mall or a car agency, or do we have a school and a hospital? And typically, if you poll the women of the area, they will say school, hospital, drinking water. And if you poll the men of the area, they would say malls and car agencies and movie halls and so on and so forth. And those actually have to be debated at the local council to determine how that land is going to be developed. The final thing you asked was, is it too driven by civil society? Right? Well, the purpose of this was to have civil society-driven approaches to poverty reduction, because the understanding of poverty was that poverty is not just poverty of income, but poverty is basically marginalization from any public policy process, right? Which is why I think they have more balance. It doesn't appear to be so unbalanced. Yes, just half a second. But the energies have to be coming from below, because that's the way the planning is organized. Final question: what would I tell politicians in Europe? One would be that development has to come from people, and people cannot be put into development programs. That's one. The other thing is solidarity. Really, solidarity seems to be the abiding force with which women who are so multiply marginalized can carve a space. And it is not, it's a value in itself rather than just a resource to gain more, make more gains.
Well, thank you to you all. Of course, it's very difficult to conclude with some conclusion, this very interesting panel. If I can say only two final words, coming back to the title of our session, Welfare Regime and Social Service Provisioning, because some of our reflection go wider and of this. First, of course, we can discuss longer about this question of do we need a stronger state to have a strong social economy? I can say that in any case, also from my personal experience, either in Europe or in Africa, social and solidarity economy cannot stand and develop it in the long term if you don't have a strong state or if the state is too much weak. Of course, we need that the state came out from the providing services, but not from the regulating, controlling, and assuring the standards. So this question, if we look in the short term, perhaps we have, in most of cases, the capacity of people of auto-organizing where the state is absent, weak, or totally out of this priority. But in the long term, it cannot stand for a long period. And the second conclusion that, of course, we need the definition. We urge theoretical work and theoretical approach, but we have not to become prisoner of definition, because reality and what has been demonstrated and people are always much more creative, and this is our chance.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.